16. The Cheese Boys. My friend Mongani was a short, bald, super buff guy. He wasn't always that way. His whole life he'd been skinny, and then a bodybuilding magazine found its way into his hands and changed his life. Mongani was one of those people who brought out the best in everybody. He was that friend who believed in you and saw the potential in you that nobody else did, which was why so many of the township kids gravitated toward him, and why I gravitated toward him as well. Mongani was always popular, but his reputation really took off when he beat up one of the more infamous bullies in the school. That cemented his status as sort of the leader and protector of the township kids. Mongani lived in Alex, but I never visited him there while we were still in school. He'd always come to my house in Highlands North. I'd been to Alex a few times for brief visits, but I'd never spent any real time there. I've never been there at night. Let's put it that way. Going to Alex during the day is different from going there at night. The place was nicknamed Gomorrah for a reason. One day after school, not long before we matriculated, Mongani walked up to me on the quad. "Hey, let's go to the hood," he said. "The hood?" At first, I had no idea what he was talking about. I knew the word hood from rap songs, and I knew the different townships where black people lived, but I had never used the one to describe the other. The walls of apartheid were coming down just as American hip-hop was blowing up, and hip-hop made it cool to be from the hood. Before, living in a township was something to be ashamed of. It was the bottom of the bottom. Then, we had movies like Boys in the Hood and Menace to Society, and they made the hood look cool. The characters in those movies, in the songs, they owned it. Kids in the townships started doing the same, wearing their identity as a badge of honor. You were no longer from the township. You were from the hood. Being from Alex gave you way more street cred than living in Highlands North. So when Mongani said, "Let's go to the hood," I was curious about what he meant. I wanted to find out more. When Mongani took me to Alex, we entered, as most people do, from the Sandton side. You ride through one of the richest neighborhoods in Johannesburg, past palatial mansions and huge money. Then you go through the industrial belt of Wynberg that cordons off the rich and white from the poor and black. At the entrance to Alex, there's the huge minibus rank and the bus station. It's the same bustling, chaotic third world marketplace you see in James Bond and Jason Bourne movies. It's Grand Central Station, but outdoors. Everything's dynamic. Everything's in motion. Nothing feels like it was there yesterday, and nothing feels like it'll be there tomorrow. But every day, it looks exactly the same. Right next to the minibus rank, of course, is a KFC. That's one thing about South Africa. There's always a KFC. KFC found the black people. KFC did not play games. They were in the hood before McDonald's, before Burger King, before anyone. KFC was like, "Yo, we're here for you." Once you go past the minibus rank, you're in Alex proper. I've been in few places where there's an electricity like there is in Alex. It's a hive of constant human activity, all day long, people coming and going, gangsters hustling, guys on the corner doing nothing, kids running around. There's nowhere for all that energy to go, no mechanism for it to dissipate. So it erupts periodically in epic acts of violence and crazy parties. 1 minute, it'll be a placid afternoon, people hanging out, doing their thing. And the next thing you know, there's a cop car chasing gangsters, flying through the streets, a gun battle going off, helicopters circling overhead. Then, 10 minutes later, it's like it never happened. Everyone's back to hanging out, back to the hustle, coming and going, running around. Alex is laid out on a grid, a series of avenues. The streets are paved, but the sidewalks are mostly dirt. The color scheme is cinder block and corrugated iron, gray and dark gray, punctuated by bright splashes of color. Someone's painted a wall lime green, or there's a bright red sign above a takeaway shop. Or maybe somebody's picked up a bright blue piece of sheet metal just by luck. There's little in the way of basic sanitation. Trash is everywhere. Typically, a garbage fire going down some side street. There's always something burning in the hood. As you walk, There's every smell you can imagine. People are cooking, eating takeaways in the streets. Some family has a shack that's jury-rigged onto the back of someone else's shack, and they don't have any running water. So they've bathed in a bucket from the outdoor tap and then dumped the dirty water in the streets, where it runs into the river of sewage that's already there because the water system has backed up again. There's a guy fixing cars who thinks he knows what he's doing, but he doesn't. He's dumping old motor oil into the streets, and now the oil is combining with the dirty bathwater to make a river of filth running down the streets. There's probably a goat hanging around. There's always a goat. As you're walking, sound washes over you. The steady thrum of human activity, people talking in a dozen different languages, chatting, haggling, arguing. There's music playing constantly. You've got traditional South African music coming from one corner, someone blasting Dolly Parton from the next corner, and somebody driving past pumping the Notorious B.I.G. The hood was a complete sensory overload for me. But within the chaos, there was order, a system, a social hierarchy based on where you lived. First Avenue was not cool at all, because it was right next to the commotion of the minibus rank. Second Avenue was nice because it had semi-houses that were built when there was still some sort of formal settlement going on. Third, Fourth, and Fifth Avenues were nicer for the township. These were the established families, the old money. Then, from 6th Avenue on down, it got really shitty. More shacks and shanties. There were some schools, a few soccer fields. There were a couple of hostels. Giant projects built by government for housing migrant workers. You never wanted to go there. That's where the serious gangsters were. You only went there if you needed to buy an AK-47. After 20th Avenue, you hit the Yuxke River. And on the far side of that, across the Roosevelt Street Bridge, was East Bank, the newest, nicest part of the hood. East Bank was where the government had gone in, cleared out the squatters and their shacks, and started to build actual homes. It was still low-income housing, but decent, two-bedroom houses with tiny yards. The families who lived there had a bit of money and usually sent their kids out of the hood to better schools, like Sandringham. Bongani's parents lived in East Bank, at the corner of Roosevelt and Springbok Crescent. And after walking from the minibus rank through the hood, we wound up there, hanging around outside his house on the low brick wall down the middle of Springbok Crescent, doing nothing, shooting the shit. I didn't know it then, but I was about to spend the next 3 years of my life hanging out at that very spot. I graduated from high school when I was 17, and by that point, life at home had become toxic because of my stepfather. I didn't want to be there anymore, and my mom agreed that I should move out. She helped me move to a cheap, roach-infested flat in a building down the road. My plan, insofar as I had one, was to go to university to be a computer programmer. But we couldn't afford the tuition. I needed to make money. The only way I knew how to make money was selling pirated CDs. And one of the best places to sell CDs was in the hood, because that's where the minibus rank was. Minibus drivers were always looking for new songs, because having good music was something they used to attract customers. Another nice thing about the hood was that it's super cheap. You can get by on next to nothing. There's a meal you can get in the hood called a kota. It's a quarter loaf of bread. You scrape out the bread, then you fill it with fried potatoes, a slice of bologna, and some pickled mango relish called acha. That costs a couple of rand. The more money you have, the more upgrades you can buy. If you have a bit more money, you can throw in a hot dog. If you have a bit more than that, you can throw in a proper sausage, like a bratwurst, or maybe a fried egg. The biggest one with all the upgrades is enough to feed 3 people. For us, the ultimate upgrade was to throw on a slice of cheese. Cheese was always the thing because it was so expensive. Forget the gold standard. The hood operated on the cheese standard. Cheese on anything was money. If you got a burger, that was cool. But if you got a cheeseburger, that meant you had more money than a guy who just got a hamburger. Cheese on a sandwich, cheese in your fridge, that meant you were living the good life. In any township in South Africa, if you had a bit of money, people would say, "Oh, you're a cheese boy." In essence, you're not really hood because your family has enough money to buy cheese. In Alex, because Bongani and his crew lived in East Bank, they were considered cheese boys. Ironically, because they lived on the first street just over the river, they were looked down on as the scruff of East Bank, and the kids in the nicer houses higher up in East Bank were the cheesier cheese boys. Bongani and his crew would never admit to being cheese boys. They would insist, "We're not cheese, we're hood." But then the real hood guys would say, "Hey, you're not hood, you're cheese." "We're not cheese," Bongani's guys would say, pointing further up East Bank, "they're cheese." It was all a bunch of ridiculous posturing about who was hood and who was cheese. Bongani was the leader of his crew, the guy who got everyone together and got things moving. Then there was Mzi, Bongani's henchman. Small guy, just wanted to tag along, be in the mix. Beggy was the drinks man, always finding us booze and always coming up with an excuse to drink. Then there was Tlokotsi. We called him G, Mr. Nice Guy. All G was interested in was women. If women were in the mix, he was in the game. Then finally, there was Hitler, the life of the party. Hitler just wanted to dance. Cheese boys were in a uniquely fucked situation when apartheid ended. It is one thing to be born in the hood and know that you will never leave the hood. But the cheese boy has been shown the world outside. His family has done okay. They have a house. They've sent him to a decent school. Maybe he's even matriculated. He has been given more potential, but he has not been given more opportunity. He has been given an awareness of the world that is out there, but he has not been given the means to reach it. The unemployment rate, technically speaking, was lower in South Africa during apartheid, which makes sense. There was slavery. That's how everyone was employed. When democracy came, everyone had to be paid a minimum wage. The cost of labor went up, and suddenly, millions of people were out of work. The unemployment rate for young black men post-apartheid shot up, sometimes as high as 50%. What happens to a lot of guys is they finish high school, and they can't afford university. And even little retail jobs can be hard to come by when you're from the hood and you look and talk a certain way. So, for many young men in South African townships, freedom looks like this. Every morning, they wake up. Maybe their parents go to work, or maybe not. Then they go outside and chill on the corner the whole day, talking shit. They're free. They've been taught how to fish, but no one will give them a fishing rod. One of the first things I learned in the hood is that there's a very fine line between civilian and criminal. We like to believe we live in a world of good guys and bad guys. And in the suburbs, it's easy to believe that, because getting to know a career criminal in the suburbs is a difficult thing. But then you go to the hood, and you see there are so many shades in between. In the hood, gangsters were your friends and neighbors. You knew them. You talked to them on the corner, saw them at parties. They were a part of your world. You knew them from before they became gangsters. It wasn't, "Hey, that's a crack dealer." It was, "Oh, little Jimmy's selling crack now." The weird thing about these gangsters was that they were all, at a glance, identical. They drove the same red sports car. They dated the same beautiful 18-year-old girls. It was strange. It was like they didn't have personalities. They shared a personality. One could be the other, and the other could be the one. They'd each studied how to be that gangster. In the hood, even if you're not a hardcore criminal, crime is in your life in some way or another. There are degrees of it. It's everyone from the mom buying some food that fell off the back of a truck to feed her family, all the way up to the gangs selling military-grade weapons and hardware. The hood made me realize that crime succeeds because crime does the one thing the government doesn't do. Crime cares. Crime is grassroots. Crime looks for the young kids who need support and a lifting hand. Crime offers internship programs and summer jobs and opportunities for advancement. Crime gets involved in the community. Crime doesn't discriminate. My life of crime started off small, selling pirated CDs on the corner. That in itself was a crime. And today I feel like I owe all these artists money for stealing their music. But by hood standards, it didn't even qualify as illegal. At the time, it never occurred to any of us that we were doing anything wrong. If copying CDs is wrong, why would they make CD writers? The garage of Bongani's house opened up onto Springbok Crescent. Every morning, we'd open up the doors, run an extension cord out into the street, set up a table, and play music. People would walk by and ask, "What's that? Can I get one, please?" Our corner was also where a lot of minibus drivers ended their routes and turned around to loop back to the minibus rank. They'd swing by, place an order, come back, pick it up. Swing by, place an order, come back, pick it up. We spent our whole day running out to them, going back to the garage to make more mixes, and going back out to sell. There was a converted shipping container around the corner where we'd hang out when we got tired of the wall. It had a payphone installed inside that we'd use to call people. When things were slow, we'd wander back and forth between the container and the wall, talking and hanging out with the other people with nothing to do in the middle of the day. We'd talk to drug dealers, talk to gangsters. Every now and then, the cops would come crashing through. A day in the life of the hood. Next day, same thing. Selling slowly evolved into hustling, because Bongani saw all the angles and knew how to exploit them. Like Tom, Bongani was a hustler. But where Tom was only about the short con, Bongani had schemes. If we do this, we get that. Then we can flip that for the other thing, which gives us the leverage we need to get something bigger. Some minibus drivers couldn't pay up front, for example. "I don't have the money because I've just started my shift," they'd say. "But I need new music. Can I owe you guys some form of credit? I'll owe you a ride. I'll pay you at the end of my shift, at the end of the week." So we started letting drivers buy on credit, charging them a bit of interest. We started making more money. Never more than a few hundred, maybe 1,000 rand at a time. But it was all cash on hand. Bongani was quick to realize the position we were in. Cash is the one thing everyone in the hood needs. Everyone's looking for a short-term loan for something, to pay a bill, or pay a fine, or just hold things together. People started coming to us and asking for money. Bongani would cut a deal and then he'd come to me. "Yo, we're going to make a deal with this guy. We're going to loan him 100 and he's going to give us back 120 at the end of the week." I'd say, "Okay." Then the guy would come back and give us 120 rand. Then we did it again. Then we did it some more. We started to double our money, then triple our money. Cash gave us leverage in the hood's barter economy as well. It's common knowledge that if you're standing at a corner of a main street in the hood, somebody's gonna try to sell you something. "Yo, yo, yo, my man, you want some weed? You wanna buy a VCR? You wanna buy a DVD player? Yo, I'm selling a TV." That's just how it works. Let's say we see two guys haggling on the corner. A crackhead trying to sell a DVD player and some working dude who wants it but doesn't have the money because he hasn't got his wages yet. They're going back and forth, but the crackhead wants the money now. Crackheads don't wait. There's no layaway plan with a crackhead. So Bongani steps in and takes the working guy aside. "Look, I understand you can't pay for the DVD player now," Bongani says. "But how much are you willing to pay for it?" "I'll pay 120, he says. "Okay, cool." Then Bongani takes the crackhead aside. "How much do you want for the DVD player?"
"I want 140.
"Okay, listen, you're a crackhead. This is a stolen DVD player. I'm gonna give you 50. The crackhead protests a bit, but then he takes the money, because he's a crackhead, and it's cash, and crack is all about the now. Then Bongani goes back to the working guy. "All right, we'll do 120. Here's your DVD player, it's yours."
"But I don't have the 120.
"It's cool. You can take it now. Only instead of 120, you give us 140 when you get your wages."
"Okay."
So now we've invested 50 rand with the crackhead, and that gets us 140 from the working guy. But Bongani would see a way to flip it and grow it again. Let's say this guy who bought the DVD player worked at a shoe store. "How much do you pay for a pair of Nikes with your staff discount?" Bongani would ask.
"I can get a pair of Nikes for 150.
"Okay, instead of you giving us 140, we'll give you 10
and you get us a pair of Nikes with your discount. So now, this guy's walking away with a DVD player and 10 rand in his pockets. He's feeling like he got a good deal. He brings us the Nikes, and then we go to one of the cheesier cheese boys up in East Bank, and we say, "Yo, dude, we know you want the new Jordans. They're 300 in the shops. We'll sell them to you for 200. We sell him the shoes, and now we've gone and turned 60 rand into 200. That's the hood. Someone's always buying, someone's always selling, and the hustle is about trying to be in the middle of the whole thing. None of it was legal. Nobody knew where anything came from. The guy who got us Nikes, did he really have a staff discount? You don't know. You don't ask. It's just, hey, look what I found. And cool, how much do you want? That's the international code. At first, I didn't know not to ask. I remember one time we bought a car stereo or something like that. "But who did this belong to?" I said. "Hey, don't worry about it," one of the guys told me. "White people have insurance."
"Insurance?"
"Yeah. When white people lose stuff, they have insurance policies that pay them cash for what they've lost. So it's like they've lost nothing."
"Oh, okay," I said. "Sounds nice." And that was as far as we ever thought about it. When white people lose stuff, they get money. Just another nice perk of being white.
It's easy to be judgmental about crime when you live in a world wealthy enough to be removed from it. But the hood taught me that everyone has different notions of right and wrong, different definitions of what constitutes crime, and what level of crime they're willing to participate in. If a crackhead comes through and he's got a crate of cornflakes boxes he's stolen out of the back of a supermarket, the poor mom isn't thinking, "I'm aiding and abetting a criminal by buying these cornflakes." No, she's thinking, "My family needs food, and this guy has cornflakes," and she buys the cornflakes. My own mother, my super religious, law-abiding mother, who used to shit on me about breaking the rules and learning to behave. I'll never forget one day I came home, and in the kitchen was a giant box of frozen burger patties, like 200 of them, from a takeaway place called Blacksteer. A burger at Blacksteer cost at least 20 rand. "What the hell is this?" I said. "Oh, some guy at work had these and was selling them," she said. "I got a great discount." "But where did he get it from?"
"I don't know. He said he knew somebody who..."
"Mom, he stole it."
"We don't know that."
"We do know that. Where the hell is some guy going to get all of these burger patties from randomly?" Of course, we ate the burgers. Then we thanked God for the meal. When Bongani first said to me, "Let's go to the hood," I thought we were going to sell CDs and DJ parties in the hood. It turned out that we were selling CDs and DJing parties in order to capitalize a payday lending and pawn shop operation in the hood. Very quickly, that became our core business. Every day in the hood was the same. I'd wake up early. Bongani would meet me at my flat, and we'd catch a minibus to Alex with my computer, carrying the giant tower and the giant heavy monitor the whole way. We'd set it up in Bongani's garage and start the first batch of CDs. Then we'd walk. We'd go down to the corner of 19th and Roosevelt for breakfast. When you're trying to stretch your money, food is where you have to be careful. You have to plan, or you'll eat your profits. So every morning for breakfast, we eat vetkoek, which is fried dough, basically. Those were cheap, like 50 cents a pop. We could buy a bunch of those and have enough energy to sustain us until later on in the day. Then we'd sit on the corner and eat. While we ate, we'd be picking up orders from the minibus drivers as they went past. After that, we'd go back to Bongani's garage, listen to music, lift weights, make the CDs. Around 10 or 11, the drivers would start coming back from their morning routes. We'd take the CDs and head out to the corner for them to pick up their stuff. Then we'd just be on the corner, hanging out, meeting characters, seeing who came by, seeing where the day was going to take us. A guy needs this. A guy is selling that. You never knew what it was going to be. There was always a big rush of business at lunch.
We'd be all over Alexandra, hitting different shops and corners, making deals with everyone. We'd get free rides from the minibus drivers because we'd hop in with them and use it as an opportunity to talk about what music they needed. But secretly, we were riding with the guy for free. "Hey, we want to collect orders. We'll talk to you while you drive. What do you need? What music are you looking for? Do you need the new Maxwell? Okay, we got the new Maxwell. Okay, we'll talk to you later. We'll jump out here." Then we'd hop on another ride, going wherever we were going next. After lunch, business would die down, and that's when we'd get our lunch, usually the cheapest thing we could afford, like a smiley with some maize meal. A smiley is a goat's head. They're boiled and covered with chili pepper. We call them smileys because when you're done eating all the meat off of it, the goat looks like it's smiling at you from the plate. The cheeks and the tongue are quite delicious, but the eyes are disgusting. They pop in your mouth. You put the eyeball into your mouth and you bite it, and it's just a ball of pus that pops. It has no crunch. It has no chew. It has no flavor that is appetizing in any way. After lunch, we'd head back to the garage, relax, sleep off the meal, and make more CDs. In the afternoons, we'd see a lot of moms. Moms loved us. They were some of our best customers. Since moms run the household, they're the ones looking to buy that box of soap that fell off the back of the truck. And they were more likely to buy it from us than from some crackhead. Dealing with crackheads is unpleasant. We were upstanding, well-spoken East Bank boys. We could even charge a premium because we added that layer of respectability to the transaction. Moms are also often the most in need of short-term loans to pay for this or that for the family. Again, they'd rather deal with us than with some gangster loan shark. Moms knew we weren't going to break anyone's legs if they couldn't pay. We didn't believe in that. Also, we weren't capable of it. Let's not forget that part. But that's where Bongani's brilliance came in. He always knew what a person could provide pending their failure to pay. We made some of the craziest trades. Moms in the hood are protective of their daughters, especially if their daughters are pretty. In Alex, there were girls who got locked up. They went to school, came straight home, and went straight into the house. They weren't allowed to leave. Boys weren't allowed to talk to them, weren't even allowed to hang around the house, none of that. Some guy was always going on about some locked away girl. "She's so beautiful. I'll do anything to get with her." But he couldn't. Nobody could. Then that mom would need a loan. Once we lent her the money, until she paid us back, she couldn't chase us away from her house. We'd go by and hang out, chat, make small talk. The daughter would be right there, but the mom wouldn't say, "Don't talk to these boys." The loan gave us access to establish a relationship with the mom. We'd get invited to stay for dinner. Once the mom knew we were nice, upstanding guys, she'd agree to let us take her daughter to a party, as long as we promised to get her home safely. So then, we'd go to the guy who'd been so desperate to meet the daughter. "Hey, let's make a deal. We'll bring the girl to your party, and you get to hang out with her. How much can you give us?" "I don't have money," he'd say, "but I have some cases of beer." "Okay, so tonight we're going to this party. You give us 2 cases of beer for the party." "Cool." Then we'd go to the party. We'd invite the girl, who was usually thrilled to escape her mother's prison. The guy would bring the beer. He'd get to hang out with the girl. We'd write off the mom's debt to show her our gratitude, and we'd make our money back selling the beer. There was always a way to make it work. And often, that was the most fun part. Working the angles. Solving the puzzle. Seeing what goes where. Who needs what. Whom we can connect with who can then get us the money. At the peak of our operation, we probably had around 10,000 rand in capital. We had loans going out and interest coming in. We had our stockpile of Jordans and DVD players we'd bought to resell. We'd also had to buy blank CDs, hire minibuses to go to all our DJ gigs, feed 5 guys 3 times a day. We kept track of everything on the computer. Having lived in my mom's world, I knew how to do spreadsheets. We had a Microsoft Excel document laid out, everybody's name, how much they owed, when they paid, when they didn't pay. After work was when business started to pick up. Minibus drivers picking up one last order, men coming home from work. The men weren't looking for soap and cornflakes. They wanted the gear. DVD players, CD players, PlayStation games. More guys would come through selling stuff too, because they'd been out hustling and stealing all day. There'd be a guy selling a cell phone, a guy selling some leather jackets, a guy selling shoes. There was this one dude who looked like a black version of Mr. Burns from The Simpsons. He'd always come by at the end of his shift with the most random, useless crap, like an electric toothbrush without the charger. One time, he brought us an electric razor. What the hell is this? It's an electric razor. An electric razor? We're black. Do you know what these things do to our skin? Do you see anyone around here who can use an electric razor? We never knew where he was getting this stuff from, because you don't ask. Eventually, we pieced it together, though. He worked at the airport. It was all the crap he was boosting from people's luggage. Slowly, the rush would start to taper off, and we'd wind down. We'd make our last collections, go over our CD stock, balance our accounts. If there was a party to DJ that night, we'd start getting ready for that. Otherwise, we'd buy a few beers and sit around and drink, talk about the day, listen to the gunshots in the distance. Gunshots went off every night, and we'd always try to guess what kind of gun it was. That's a 9mm. Usually, there'd be a police chase. Cop cars flying through after some guy with a stolen car. Then, everyone would go home for dinner with their families. I'd take my computer, get back in a minibus, ride home, sleep, and then come back and do it all again the next day. A year passed. Then two. I had stopped planning for school and was no closer to having the money to enroll. The tricky thing about the hood is that you're always working, 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 and you feel like something's happening. But really, nothing's happening at all. I was out there every day from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. And every day it was, how do we turn 10 rand into 20? How do we turn 20 into 50? How do I turn 50 into 100? At the end of the day, we'd spend it on food and maybe some beers. And then we'd go home and come back and it was, how do we turn 10 into 20? How do we turn 20 into 50? It was a whole day's work to flip that money. You had to be walking, be moving, be thinking. You had to get to a guy, find a guy, meet a guy. There were many days we'd end up back at zero, but I always felt like I'd been very productive. Hustling is to work what surfing the internet is to reading. If you add up how much you read in a year on the internet, tweets, Facebook, posts, lists, you've read the equivalent of a shit ton of books. But in fact, you've read no books in a year. When I look back on it, that's what hustling was. It's maximal effort put into minimal gain. It's a hamster wheel. If I'd put all that energy into studying, I'd have earned an MBA. Instead, I was majoring in hustling, something no university would give me a degree for. When I first went into Alex, I was drawn by the electricity and the excitement of it. But more important, I was accepted there, more so than I'd been in high school or anywhere else. When I first showed up, a couple of people raised an eyebrow. Who is this colored kid? But the hood doesn't judge. If you want to be there, you can be there. Because I didn't live in the hood, I was technically an outsider in the hood, but for the first time in my life, I didn't feel like one. The hood is also a low-stress, comfortable life. All your mental energy goes into getting by, so you don't have to ask yourself any of the big questions. Who am I? Who am I supposed to be? Am I doing enough? In the hood, you can be a 45-year-old man living in your mom's house asking people for money, and it's not looked down on. You never feel like a failure in the hood, because someone's always worse off than you. And you don't feel like you need to do more, because the biggest success isn't that much higher than you either. It allows you to exist in a state of suspended animation. The hood has a wonderful sense of community to it as well. Everyone knows everyone, from the crackhead all the way through to the policeman. People take care of one another. The way it works in the hood is that if any mom asks you to do something, you have to say yes. Can I send you? Is the phrase. It's like everyone's your mom and you're everyone's kid. Can I send you? Yeah, what do you need? I need you to go buy milk and bread. Yeah, cool. Then she gives you some money and you go buy milk and bread. As long as you aren't busy and it doesn't cost you anything, you don't say no. The biggest thing in the hood is that you have to share. You can't get rich on your own. You have money? Why aren't you helping people? The old lady on the block needs help. Everyone pitches in. You're buying beer? You buy for everyone. You spread it around. Everyone must know that your success benefits the community in one way or another, or you become a target. The township polices itself as well. If someone is caught stealing, the township deals with them. If someone's caught breaking into a house, the township deals with them. If you're caught raping a woman, pray to God the police find you before the township does. If a woman is being hit, people don't get involved. There are too many questions with a beating. What's the fight about? Who's responsible? Who started it? But rape is rape. Theft is theft. You've desecrated the community. The hood was strangely comforting, but comfort can be dangerous. Comfort provides a floor, but also a ceiling. In our crew, our friend G was like the rest of us, unemployed, hanging out. Then he got a job at a nice clothing store. Every morning, he went to work, and the guys would tease him about going to work. We'd see him headed out all dressed up, and everyone would be laughing at him. Oh, G, look at you in your fancy clothes. Oh, G, going to see the white man today, huh? Oh, G, don't forget to bring some books back from the library. One morning, after a month of G working at the place, we were hanging out on the wall, and G came out in his slippers and his socks. He wasn't dressed for work. Yo, G, what's going on? What's up with the job? Oh, I don't work there anymore. Why? They accused me of stealing something and I got fired. And I'll never forget thinking to myself that it felt like he did it on purpose. He sabotaged himself so that he'd get accepted back into the group again. The hood has a gravitational pull. It never leaves you behind, but it also never lets you leave. Because by making the choice to leave, you're insulting the place that raised you and made you and never turned you away. And that place fights you back. As soon as things start going well for you in the hood, it's time to go. Because the hood will drag you back in. It will find a way. There'll be a guy who steals a thing and puts it in your car and the cops find it. Something. You can't stay. You think you can. You'll start doing better and you'll bring your hood friends out to a nice club. And the next thing you know, somebody starts a fight and one of your friends pulls a gun and somebody's getting shot. And you're left standing around going, what just happened? The hood happened. One night, I was DJing a party, not in Alex, but right outside Alex in Lombardy East, a nicer, middle-class black neighborhood. The police were called about the noise. They came busting in, wearing riot gear and pointing machine guns. That's how our police roll. We don't have small and then big. What Americans call SWAT is just our regular police. They came looking for the source of the music, and the music was coming from me. This one cop came over to where I was with my computer and pulled this massive assault rifle on me. You gotta shut this down right now. Okay, okay, I said. I'm shutting it down. But I was running Windows 95. Windows 95 took forever to shut down. I was closing windows, shutting down programs. I had one of those fat Seagate drives that damaged easily, and I didn't want to cut the power and possibly damage the drive. This cop clearly didn't give a fuck about any of that. Shut it down! Shut it down! I am shutting it down. I have to close the programs. The crowd was getting angry, and the cop was getting nervous. He turned his gun away from me and shot the computer. Only he clearly didn't know anything about computers because he shot the monitor. The monitor exploded, but the music kept playing. Now there was chaos.
music blaring and everyone running and panicking because of the gunshots. I yanked the power cord out of the tower to shut the thing down. Then the cops started firing tear gas into the crowd. The tear gas had nothing to do with me or the music. Tear gas is just what the police use to shut down parties in black neighborhoods, like the club, turning on the lights to tell everyone to go home. I lost the hard drive. Even though the cops shot the monitor, the explosion somehow fried the thing. The computer would still boot up, but it couldn't read the drive. My music library was gone. Even if I'd had the money for a new hard drive, it had taken me years to amass the music collection. There was no way to replace it. The DJing business was over. The CD selling business was done. All of a sudden, our crew lost its main revenue stream. All we had left was the hustle, and we hustled even harder, taking the bit of cash we had on hand and trying to double it, buying this to flip it for that. We started eating into our savings, and in less than a month, we were running on dust. Then one evening after work, our friend from the airport, the black Mr. Burns, came by.
"Hey, look what I found," he said.
"What have you got?"
"A camera."
I'll never forget that camera. It was a digital camera. We bought it from him, and I took it and turned it on. It was full of pictures of a nice white family on vacation, and I felt like shit. The other things we'd bought had never mattered to me. Nikes, electric toothbrushes, electric razors, who cares? Yeah, some guy might get fired because of the pallets of cornflakes that went missing from the supermarkets, but that's degrees removed. You don't think about it. But this camera had a face. I went through those pictures, knowing how much my family pictures meant to me, and I thought, I haven't stolen a camera. I've stolen someone's memories. I've stolen part of someone's life. It's such a strange thing, but in 2 years of hustling, I never once thought of it as a crime. I honestly didn't think it was bad. It's just stuff people found. White people have insurance. Whatever rationalization was handy. In society, we do horrible things to one another because we don't see the person it affects. We don't see their face. We don't see them as people. Which was the whole reason the hood was built in the first place. To keep the victims of apartheid out of sight and out of mind. Because if white people ever saw black people as human, they would see that slavery is unconscionable. We live in a world where we don't see the ramifications of what we do to others, because we don't live with them. It would be a whole lot harder for an investment banker to rip off people with subprime mortgages if he actually had to live with the people he was ripping off. If we could see one another's pain and empathize with one another, it would never be worth it to us to commit the crimes in the first place. As much as we needed the money, I never sold the camera. I felt too guilty, like it would be bad karma, which I know sounds stupid and it didn't get the family their camera back, but I just couldn't do it. That camera made me confront the fact that there were people on the other end of this thing I was doing, and what I was doing was wrong. One night, our crew got invited to dance in Soweto against another crew. Hitler was going to compete with their best dancer, Hector, who was one of the best dancers in South Africa at the time. This invitation was a huge deal. We were going over there, repping our hood. Alex and Soweto have always had a huge rivalry. Soweto was seen as the snobbish township, and Alexandra was seen as the gritty and dirty township. Hector was from Diepkloof, which was the nice, well-off part of Soweto. Diepkloof was where the first million-rand houses were built after democracy. "Hey, we're not a township anymore. We're building nice things now." That was the attitude. That's who we were up against. Hitler practiced a whole week. We took a minibus over to Diepkloof the night of the dance. Me and Bongani, Mzi and Beggy and G, and Hitler. Hector won the competition. Then G was caught kissing one of their girls, and it turned into a fight and everything broke down. On our way back to Alex, around 1 in the morning, as we were pulling out of Diepkloof to get onto the freeway, some cops
pulled our minibus over. They made everyone get out, and they searched it. We were standing outside, lined up alongside the car, when one of the cops came back.
"We found a gun," he said. "Whose gun is it?"
We all shrugged. "We don't know," we said.
"Nope, somebody knows. It's somebody's gun."
"Officer, we really don't know," Bongani said.
He slapped Bongani hard across the face.
"You're bullshitting me."
Then he went down the line, slapping each of us across the face, berating us about the gun. We couldn't do anything but stand there and take it.
"You guys are trash," the cop said. "Where are you from?"
"Alex."
"Oh, okay, I see. Dogs from Alex. You come here and you rob people and you rape women and you hijack cars. Bunch of fucking hoodlums."
"No, we're dancers. We don't know."
"I don't care. You're all going to jail until we figure out whose gun this is."
At a certain point, we realized what was going on. This cop was shaking us down for a bribe. Spot fine is the euphemism everyone uses. You go through this elaborate dance with the cop where you say the thing without saying the thing.
"Can't we do something?" you ask the officer.
"What do you want me to do?"
"We're really sorry, officer. What can we do?"
"You tell me."
Then you're supposed to make up a story whereby you indicate to the cop how much money you have on you, which we couldn't do because we didn't have any money. So he took us to jail. It was a public bus. It could have been anyone's gun. But the guys from Alex were the only ones who got arrested. Everyone else in the car was free to go. The cops took us to the police station and threw us in a cell and pulled us out one by one for questioning. When they pulled me aside, I had to give my home address, Highlands North. The cop gave me the most confused look.
"You are not from Alex," he said. "What are you doing with these crooks?"
I didn't know what to say. He glared at me hard.
"Listen here, rich boy. You think it's fun running around with these guys. This isn't play anymore. Just tell me the truth about your friends and the gun, and I'll let you go."
I told him no, and he threw me back in the cell. We spent the night. And the next day I called a friend who said he could borrow the money from his dad to get us out. Later that day, the dad came down and paid the money. The cops kept calling it bail, but it was a bribe. We were never formally arrested or processed. There was no paperwork. We got out, and everything was fine, but it rattled us. Every day, we were out in the streets, hustling, trying to act as if we were in some way down with the gangs. But the truth was, we were always more cheese than hood. We had created this idea of ourselves as a defense mechanism to survive in the world we were living in. Bongani and the other East Bank guys, because of where they were from, what they looked like, they just had very little hope. You've got two options in that situation. You take the retail job, flip burgers at McDonald's, if you're one of the lucky few who even gets that much. The other option is to toughen up, put up this facade. You can't leave the hood, so you survive by the rules of the hood. I chose to live in that world, but I wasn't from that world. If anything, I was an imposter. Day to day, I was in it as much as everyone else. But the difference was that in the back of my mind, I knew I had other options. I could leave. They couldn't. Once, when I was 10 years old, visiting my dad in Yeovil, I needed batteries for one of my toys. My mom had refused to buy me new batteries because, of course, she thought it was a waste of money. So I snuck out to the shops and shoplifted a pack. A security guard busted me on the way out, pulled me into his office and called my mom. "We've caught your son shoplifting batteries," he said. "You need to come and fetch him."
"No," she said. "Take him to jail. If he's going to disobey, he needs to learn the consequences."
Then she hung up. The guard looked at me confused. Eventually, he let me go on the assumption that I was some wayward orphan. Because what mother would send her 10-year-old child to jail?